Hey everyone, thanks for tuning in to this episode of Totem Talks. So today we're going to be focusing on mental health for students. So as a result of that, there is going to be some mention of self-harm and suicide in the podcast today.
If that's something that you don't feel comfortable listening to today, then please feel free to head over to our website for some helpful links and tips on the subject. We hope you enjoy the podcast.
So yeah, I guess Sophie, can you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you're doing within the kind of mental health sphere at university?
Yeah, so I've just finished my undergraduate degree at King's College London, where I studied French and Spanish. And I'm going to be starting my master's in international child rights and development in September. And I've been involved with mental health for about 2 to 3 years now, working mainly within my university as chair of the Wellbeing Union Development Committee that we have with our students' union, one of the supervisors for our team of positive peers who we team up with Student Minds, and basically they're students who are trained to deliver training to other students about how to best support their mental health and the mental health of others. And I'm one of the supervisors for our peer health education team, and we run workshops for students. I'm also King's student lead for the University Mental Health Charter, which is another program by Student Minds. And I also work with Student Minds as an assessor for that and on their student advisory committee.
So deeply involved.
Deeply involved, yes. Very passionate.
Did you get all that, Ben?
I'm stealing you, Sophie. I mean, this is, I mean, how can I compete with that?
I don't know. I think you'll give it a go.
That's how I feel about you. So.
Oh, no.
A lot of love in this room.
It's so cool to be here. Thank you, guys. So I'm Ben. I'm a paramedic by trade, mainly with the NHS, bit of military work as well. And then in 2018, I was diagnosed with PTSD, and that started my journey to why I'm here now. And so my current role, I work within the NHS for South Central Ambulance Service, who are commissioned to provide some really big programmes. One of those is the National Ambulance Mental Health Transformation Project, which I was a clinical education manager for. But I'm also now the suicide prevention lead, so covering some really big universities down in the south. Mm-hmm. And I think that's enough to be going on with. So that's me.
Yeah, well, you both your stories are going to be told in just a moment, sort of to how you got to where you are now. But I just wanted to quickly dive in with what university life's looking like in terms of the mental health side of things. Sophie, I feel like you'll be able to cover this in terms of what you're seeing at university at the moment, what sort of problems are arising the most at this moment in time.
Yeah, so I think it's pretty much the same with any young person across the country, really, regardless of whether or not you go to university. I think it's so crucial that we have support for those students within university, within the institution, because, you know, obviously, as we know, the majority of mental health issues have started before the age of 24. And if you think about any given student body, you know, that's between the ages of 18 to 24 as an undergraduate student. And loads of these students come with pre-existing conditions. And so it's vital that we have support in place for them that's embedded as soon as they step into university, preferably even before they come to university, to best support them. You know, we're seeing increases in depression and anxiety and sadly suicides as well with students. So I think this is really why we're with Student Minds trying to, the aim is eventually all universities within the UK will be accredited with the whole university approach, which basically means that previously issues with mental health or well-being were the responsibility of counselling teams or those who worked predominantly in mental health. But what we're trying to say is that universities need to take a whole university approach to mental health. It is everybody's responsibility, regardless
it's
of where exactly
change.
You work. Exactly.
Yeah.
Because you're always going to come into contact with people who are struggling with their mental health. And it's both staff and student, because, you know, you can't have positive student well-being if you don't have good staff mental well-being. The two come in hand. So thinking really about how we can support both staff and students.
It makes so much sense when you put it like that, doesn't it? Because if students are reaching out to staff when they're having problems with their mental health, then those staff obviously need to be in a position personally where they feel they're able to deliver the support necessary to students.
How can they be supported to support students? Yeah. And then what support is there for them afterwards? How are they affected by these conversations? And how can we, you know, provide a higher education that's good for well-being where everybody can thrive, really? Yeah.
We cannot expect students to be emotionally intelligent if parents, guardians and teachers and staff are not first and foremost emotionally intelligent. So part of my role is to look at all the figures from the amazing police forces around the country to try and establish who's most at risk in terms of suicide. Mm-hmm. A bit of a buzzword, I know. Yeah. And actually, very sadly, but not unsurprisingly, this year, at the moment, top of that demographic-wise are students. So, you know, the rate of death by suicides in the under-24s, really since the pandemic, has gone up over 50%. You know, so the amazing work that Sophie and her colleagues are doing and the work we're trying to do within South Central Ambulance Service is all about normalising discussions around mental health. Yes. And here's the key thing. Not all, but a lot of mental health problems that we all have as human beings, but for the purpose of today, students, mm-hmm. are all preventable. So I'll give a really good example. So Ben, God forbid, you break a leg. You know, none of us would bat an eyelid if you were given pain medication for that leg break or you went to physical therapy. We'd all just support you and we'd be giving you love, wouldn't we? Yeah. We're still not quite there
really
yet.
Really appreciate it.
Yeah. But we're still not quite there yet with mental health. If you're going to uni, one in four people you go to uni with will be taking a mental health medication. One in four. And people don't get that. Yeah. So we need to create a culture and an environment where if someone's physically unwell, it's seen in the same light as someone who's mentally unwell, and both mental and physical absolutely interact and impact on each other.
Of course, yeah.
So it's about creating an environment and a society and a culture where it's okay to talk about it.
Yeah.
And the big thing is, I'm going to be like a broken record, 90% of the time, it's preventable. Mm-hmm. So if students have got that level of empowerment, that level of knowledge, that level of resilience, they can be fit and well and give themselves the best possible chance of not becoming mentally unwell whilst at uni and then throughout life. Sophie's absolutely bang on. The vast majority of mental health problems are well established from about the age of 15 onwards. Yeah. So I'm not saying it's too late by the time we've got to uni. Of course not, because it's never too late. But there's a lot of work we can be doing with the young adults.
Yeah, mm-hmm. absolutely. And I think that sort of just leads on to like letting our listeners know sort of what it was like for you going to university sort of for the first time and sort of the struggles that you had when you were there, if you're okay to sort of open up to us about that. We'd like to sort of hear your story and where what's gotten to where you are now and being able to help people and hopefully start to prevent some of that coming through.
Yeah, definitely. That's always the aim, isn't it? To prevention is easier than cure, right? So kind of like Ben, my involvement with mental health and the reason I've become so involved has stemmed from my own experiences as well. Uni was a massive shock to the system when I started. I'm a twin sister, so I'd gone to school with my twin and we'd never been separated from each other. And at the time I thought, you know, oh, it's nothing, you know, wrong with that. I was thinking, oh, it'll be fine. And then there was this massive transition. All of a sudden, you're on your own. Most of the students go to different cities for university, or even if they're in the same city, they're living in a different place. This is a massive adjustment, and not every student is, you know, we can't expect that all students come with the same level of knowledge about the subject that they're going to study, but also with life skills, things like, you know, budgeting, managing your finances, sorting out your living accommodation, all of these things, these life skills, and that, you know, everyone comes with different levels. And I really struggled adjusting to uni life, especially with, you know, homesickness. And I'd struggled with my mental health at school. I'd first become depressed when I was 14. I'd started self-harming at that time. And my first suicide attempt was when I was 16. And my last 2 years of school were wonderful. Well, sixth form, I guess, essentially, were really good. And I thought that my mental health was really good. And I was feeling positive about university, thinking it's a new, you know, it's an exciting new challenge, which it absolutely is. But it's also, you know, it's the best time of everyone's lives, as people say. But I think we have to be careful with that narrative, that it's not always, and especially not always immediately, that there is this massive adjustment period. It can take time, but that it's okay for these adjustments.
It's almost unfair to say
definitely.
That, I think, to put that pressure on it.
Absolutely, because I definitely struggled with that pressure. When I first started, I was not having the best time of my life, and I was thinking, what am I doing wrong? Because everybody says it's the best thing. And I was thinking, I've not found my forever friends in Freshers or Welcome Week. And just sort of thinking, panicking about that, thinking there's something wrong with me. And, you know, university was difficult for me. My best friend sadly passed away suddenly in first year. And my mental health sort of, I was struggling with the adjustment, but that sort of made it just, you know, spiral out of control, essentially. And in second year, I'd started self-harming again, which I hadn't been doing for years. I had two different eating disorders, and I had another suicide attempt just before the coronavirus pandemic. So I think for me, having come out of that, we were all in lockdown, and I was thinking, I'm just sat at home, and I like to keep busy as a person anyway. And I was thinking, how can I help others because it breaks my heart to think that I'm not the only student who's feeling this way, and I won't be, you know, for a long time. So I sort of thought, how can I help other people to not feel how I felt or to not get as low as I did? So I reached out to our Positive Peer Scheme, first of all, and then sort of started with the university stuff through there. And during that summer, applied to do a 2-year night course training in psychodynamic counselling with a view to potentially become a counsellor in the future.
Wow. So, yeah, really taking that negative and...
Yeah.
Turning it into something super positive.
Trying to. It's
very powerful.
Oh, yeah.
Such a powerful story, and you're so, like, amazing for being able to come
and tell it. Can we just take a moment? That is awesome.
Yeah, it's so impressive.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Wow.
You've definitely been through it, and you're an absolute shining example to people that are probably going through it, maybe even listening to this right now.
Yeah.
So I guess whilst we're so deep in it, is there anything that you would like to sort of say over them as they're
I guess just to know that you're really not alone, and I know that phrase is kind of thrown about a little bit, but you're really not. And I guess, I mean, this is the first time that I've ever sort of shared my story it's fine, because that's the thing I think about, it's scary because it makes you vulnerable, but actually when I was going through this, I was thinking, I wish that I had someone's story that I could listen to who'd been through the same thing as me. Because when I was really struggling, I thought, I'm going to have to pull out of university. There's no way that I can graduate. Because I'd never heard stories of people having just gone through and graduated without having to take time out or adjust their studies or something. And I was thinking, oh my goodness, I can't do it. But then I thought, or if there are people who have had the same experience, they've never shared it. And this feeds into the stigma, right? About, I know that it's been reduced, you know, in the last few years, but there definitely, in my opinion, there still is a stigma. You know, like Ben was saying about, I'm on antidepressants, and there is, you know, still a stigma about that. It took me about 2 years to finally give in and start them because I was so terrified about what people would think.
What'd you take?
I take citalopram. I started on sertraline.
Also take citalopram every day.
I also used to take citalopram.
See, so we talked about one in four, and
that's the thing.
So there you go.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's empowering, you know, and just by having conversations like this, it makes it okay to talk about it.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, and I go back to that thing. None of us bat an eyelid if we take medication for a bee sting, a headache, you know, acid reflux, whatever it might be. You know, and we need to be thinking about mental health medication in the same way.
Mm-hmm.
You are an inspiration.
Yeah, absolutely.
Thank you. So are you.
Good.
Yeah. I guess it's really hard to steer where that goes next, but I think I just would really like to know what it was for you after you've had your sip of water that managed to sort of change the narrative into that really dark place to bring you into that place where you wanted to help people. Is there something that really triggered in you?
Yeah, I think the pandemic, in part, I was supposed to have a conversation actually about interrupting my studies potentially, because I studied languages. My third year was actually supposed to be abroad. Wasn't able to happen in the end because of COVID. But in many ways, that was actually really good for me because I don't think I'd have been able to cope with going abroad where I was mentally at that time. But I didn't want to accept that. I didn't want, because I'd have felt like I'd have failed in some way, which is just ridiculous because in no way would you have failed by putting yourself first. In fact, that's the most important, that's the biggest success that you could ever do, is putting yourself and your needs first. That's, you know, there was this part of me that felt like I would have failed people if I did that. So I was really pleased that I just got to kind of essentially take a year out without taking a year out and just spend that time. And I guess what triggered it for me was I'd had a really wonderful counsellor at university.
Okay.
Really, I'd not had the best experiences with counselling before when I was younger, mainly because I was young and I didn't really think I needed it. And I thought, oh, there's no point. I'm fine. I'm absolutely fine.
Yeah, it's quite a scary word as well. Counselling, the stigma again around that.
Exactly. And trying to keep it from other people because you don't want your friends to judge and everything. And I think I hadn't really engaged, to be honest. It was probably, you know, half me as well. But I'd never sort of found counselling to work for me until I started counselling at university with this particular counsellor. And I think she definitely inspired something in me to want to become a counsellor myself, and just seeing how much it can change your life. I wanted to do that. I wanted a part of that.
Yes, that is amazing.
So did you have a moment then where things kind of made sense where you thought, gosh, this is not where I want to be and I need to do something about it?
Absolutely. I was in a recess bed in A&E for the second time, and I was so mentally unwell. It was coming out in physical symptoms. So when we're mentally unwell, if we don't deal with it or we don't recognise it, which is what happened to me because I didn't understand it, it comes out in physical symptoms.
It's really important, actually, and it's something we'll come on to in a bit, recognising that.
So I remember vividly, I'd been blagging the GP and the consultants to say, I'm fine, I can deal with it. And then obviously I couldn't. And I was in hospital because I was physically unwell. Mm-hmm. Not understanding I was mentally unwell. The minute I saw a clinical psychologist and he allowed me to understand it was PTSD, and the minute I learned that actually everything that happened to me was preventable, it cost me my marriage, my job, everything, I remember just lying there going, okay, I need to share this experience with as many possible people who are silly enough to want to listen to me so they don't make the same mistakes. You know, and I think that's really, really important. You know, there are some really debilitating mental health conditions, and I'm not taking anything away from those. And people have them all their lives, and you know, they need a lot of support to control them. But the vast majority in this country around the anxiety, depression, stress level, should we say, you know, we know from clinical research that all of those are caused by an accumulation of stress and anxiety. So if we can empower ourselves and each other to understand what stress and anxiety are, and to understand when it's a healthy response and when it's an unhealthy response, we can prevent their buildup and we can control our response to them, and we can give ourselves the best possible fighting chance of not becoming mentally unwell, which is exactly what happened to me. So my kind of passion, a bit like Sophie, my passion is to put myself in front of as many people as possible. You know, the NHS Trust I work for are amazing and they absolutely get it and they're really encouraging, to give everyone the best possible chance of not becoming unwell and ultimately to save lives. And that's exactly why I'm here today, and that's why I do the role I do.
Yeah, it's amazing.
So I guess that's, you know, brings us on quite neatly actually onto how do we spot those signs before it gets to that point? Is there anything people can look out for in themselves or in other people? And I'll throw that out to whoever wants to go first.
If we're going to understand it and control it, so that we can be as resilient and as well mentally as possible, we need to understand how we are as human beings. And this is really important. So 200,000 years ago, all of us lived as tribal nomadic hunters, and we lived in packs of family and friends. And the world was really dangerous back then. You know, another tribe was either trying to kill you or a saber-toothed tiger was trying to eat you. So the part of our brain that responded to stress and anxiety, it would respond in such a way that it would try and save our life, because back then life was a lot more dangerous. Make sense?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. That part of our brain that analyses stress and anxiety and tells us how to respond to it has not evolved in 200,000 years, but yet society and technology have. So nowadays, if something's stressing us out, an exam, a driving test, dare I say it, that hot Tinder date.
Our body
still responds in the same way, as if it's trying to save our life. And if we can understand it in the moment when we're feeling hot, sweaty, nauseous, shaky, if we can understand why we're feeling like that, we can normalise it and we can control it. It's really important, okay, key message. The part of our brain that responds to a threat, stress or anxiety, has not evolved enough to know the difference between whether something is an actual threat to life or not, so it responds in the same way, you know. And I think so people always really, when I say to people, so how do you feel when you're stressed, they go, oh, I get really sweaty, I get hot sweats. And I say to them, well, did you know that's normal, and that's designed to do that, to make your skin slippery so you can't be caught by a predator? And they go, what? And I go, yeah, that's what
like
it's
I
about.
Just like I just did
there you go.
What?
So I know we haven't got time, but you know, one of the things that I love doing is going through all those symptoms and saying to people, This is why you get butterflies. This is why you get heart palpitations. And all of it is back to that caveman or cavewoman response that was designed to save our life. Remember, we're not designed to work as quickly or at the speed of life that we do now. It's all instantaneous, isn't it? It's all shopping now
instant. And
instant gratification. You know, what we're doing now is what we should all be doing. You know, we all sit around and stare at screens now, but 50, 60 years ago, we sat around a fire and we spoke to each other. Yeah. And we don't do enough of that. You know, and so you asked me about what we should be looking out for. So first and foremost, okay, so stress is a normal response to an external thing that's happening. So when I say external, something that's happening in the here and now. So it might be that bailiff knocking on the door saying, you haven't paid your credit card bill, okay, which we're going to be seeing a lot more of, sadly, in the next kind of year. You know, it might be that friend that's become really unwell. It might be that aggressive drunk in the nightclub. But they're here, they're in front of us, okay, and we've got to deal with them, all right? That's stress. Anxiety is the same response, but to something that is an internal threat. So the best way I can describe it, because I'm a man, keep it simple, is anxiety is suffering at the hands of your own imagination. Okay, so I win the lottery. I say to Sophie, hey, where should we go? She goes, right, Barbados, Ben. And I go, okay, star. But I can't sleep that night because my brain is telling me, oh, the plane's going to fall out of the sky tomorrow. Yeah. It's not even happened. Mm. But yeah, I'm worrying. And the vast majority of us in this country suffer a lot with that anxiety. And it's that fear of something that hasn't happened yet and is probably not going to happen. But we're suffering at the hands of our imagination. So stress and anxiety are a very healthy response to a temporary situation. Mm-hmm. They become dangerous when that temporary situation turns into a permanent state. Does that make sense?
Makes perfect sense. Yeah.
It's all making too much sense.
And Sophie will absolutely back me up on this, I know you will. Yeah. 75% of people don't realise when they switch from that temporary response into a permanent unhealthy state because they're living it. Sophie, take over.
Otherwise,
I'll talk for hours.
It's brilliant. I agree, really important to make the distinction between what is healthy and what is not, because
absolutely,
there are healthy levels of stress. And, yeah, you know, it's completely normal and to not panic about that. But then, as you say, when it becomes a permanent state, it's different. So really good for making that distinction. Yeah. And social withdrawal is absolutely the key one. And, you know, to always ask the question, how are you, but ask again. Because if ever anybody said to me, how are you doing? I'd be like, oh, I'm great, I'm fine, thank you, how are you? You know, regardless of if that was true or not. So I think always
the automatic response.
The automatic response.
That's the British way.
Exactly. Yeah. So with the people that you know, just really taking the time to, you know, ask them again, are you sure? Or you seem a little tired, you seem a little off. Just providing them with the opportunity to actually to reach out to you, because sometimes it's really frightening when you're in that position. You feel that nobody cares, that you're going to be a burden to people if you talk to them about things. And actually, that's not true. But sometimes it just takes that little push to get them to open up to you, to get them to confide in you. And I think attendance, I mean, especially if we go back to the whole, you know, university idea, really, it's crucial for lecturers to notice when students aren't attending. Mm. How many weeks have they not been attending? Is there a pattern in when they're not attending? I mean, I know lots of higher education institutes or universities can access data from student cards. What times are they logging onto sites? Are they going to libraries at all hours of the night? What are these patterns looking like? In, you know, maybe reaching out to that student and saying, hi, I've noticed that you haven't been attending class, or that you've been on at 4 a.m. consistently. Can I help you with anything? Is everything okay? Do you need me to support you or signpost you to someone? I think it's often just the really little things. And I think often before we get to the stage of social withdrawal, we do have those signs that they will end up there. Irritability.
It's a big one.
You know, all of these things. And sometimes you can notice when people start to withdraw themselves before they fully withdraw themselves. So sort of catching it before the total social isolation and withdrawal happens. I think sometimes we can look out for signs like that.
And that is the earlier you do that,
always
the best possible chance. Because
yeah,
the whole idea of this prevention rather than cure is so important within mental health. It's so important.
Absolutely. It's like, you know, if we were talking about, scary word, but cancer.
Yeah.
You know, the earlier it's picked up, the better
more
the chance
you can
you
do
have.
Actually, help.
Doing something yeah about it.
That's a really good point. You know, people often forget mental health is still the biggest killer in this country for the under 55s. You just think about that. That's a big deal.
And
we can give you a list of key symptoms to look out
yes
for and when to signpost. What I would say, and Sophie, let me know if you disagree, uh-huh, is that the majority of it can be solved by having a conversation. Yeah. Okay. Let me pre-caveat that. That's when we're talking about stress, anxiety, yeah, depression. You know, that's not things like schizophrenia, bipolar, things like that.
Yeah, I think that is quite an important distinction to make, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. But so what we're talking about right now is we're talking about that build-up of stress and anxiety and when to know when that becomes unhealthy and what to do about it. So, you know, talking to peers, talking to family and loved ones, the next stage would be talking to GP.
Mm.
You know, obviously at crisis point, you safeguard life, A&E, or 111. But there's an awful lot that we could do at a grassroots level, in educational facilities, in homes, to better education around mental health to prevent
exactly
this kind of pandemic. And it has been a pandemic. It is a pandemic, you know. Very sadly, if you look at the stats, it's really, really shocking. And it's getting better, isn't it, talking about it? But it was still not quite there.
We're still not there, I don't think.
No, and it is an age thing, you know. And a lot of people don't realise this. Mental health is genetic. In the same way that problems with our hearts or lungs can be passed on from mum, dad's grandparents, certain mental health conditions can mean that you're more naturally predisposed. When I spoke about it, it turned out that my dad had a breakdown in the 70s, you know.
Which I'm guessing you never knew.
Never knew, absolutely not. Stick up a lip.
Yeah.
But actually, out of my crisis, I became a lot closer to my family because guess what? We started to open up and take those barriers away. And the people I was most frightened about talking about it, which were some guys that I used to jump out of planes with, actually, they were the most receptive. And they were like, yeah, I've been there. And it was like, oh, my gosh, it's okay to talk about this stuff.
Yeah. Because it feels so lonely when you're going through it that you feel like you're the only person that's going through it. Yeah, no one else will understand you.
Yeah.
And that's just not always true.
So, I mean, we were talking before, we hit the big red button, weren't we? But one of the things that I started doing, and I massively regret stopping it, but I said to myself, I can't be the only guy that goes through this. I can't be the only man that pushes down those emotions and refuses to talk about it because he doesn't understand them. So I started a social media account, and within about a week, I had about 3,000 followers that were bombarding me with, what can I do? Help me, help me. But because I hadn't recovered yet and I was still learning, I just stopped it, you know. And now I'm in recovery. I absolutely just want to reach out to all those people again and go, this is what you can do. And that's why I'm so passionate about my NHS work, because it's all around that, looking at figures and looking at real-time data and saying, what can we do in our society? What initiatives can we start with unis, you know, with chain restaurants that we've been talking about, that are going to prevent people ending up in a hospital bed like I did or like Sophie did, you know?
Yeah, I think it's just the complexity of it and the amount of different places that people are pointed to. I think that can sometimes really complicate you're telling me to speak to someone, you're telling me to speak, but okay, I've got that website, so I've got that website. Where should I actually go right now at this point? So I don't know if you've got the best sort of places to send people from this point.
There's a great,
you're both like,
there's a great, okay, so there's a great continuum that I'll send you guys, which you can put on your social media platforms.
Yeah, we
which
can
is a
put
really,
it on
really
our
simple,
channel.
Really simple infographic, which kind of goes from needing peer-to-peer support all the way up to need to go to A&E.
Mm-hmm.
That's a really good, quick reference guide. There are many, many fantastic localised regional organisations. But I'll be the first to admit, it is a minefield out there because there's so many different things.
Yeah.
And a really good analogy of looking at it is there's lots of trains all going to the same destination, okay, but the trains don't always talk to each other. Mm. Does that make sense?
Yeah.
So if you search Every Mind Matters, which is an NHS thing, that's a national thing, that'll give you some really quick guidance.
Mm-hmm.
There's some amazing stuff just for students, which I'll let Sophie talk about in a minute. You know, there are lots of good initiatives. There is even a fantastic thing called Ripple, which I'm a big advocate of. Sophie's nodding away, which is great. So even if a student starts to look up things that are worrying on the internet, it'll immediately stop them doing that and signpost them to some support.
Okay.
So there are lots of things out there. If someone's not comfortable talking face-to-face, you know, there's loads of great apps and websites out there, so you're not judged.
Yeah.
Yeah, like Shout.
There you can see. Over to the expert.
Not at all, no. No, but that's great that there are these alternatives, because it is scary reaching out to someone, especially someone you don't know, and talking to them about something that's so personal to you. You know, it's so vulnerable putting yourself out there to someone. So I think sometimes initiatives like Shout can just help make that first step to reaching out that bit easier for someone. I mean, for students, we've got obviously the wonderful Student Minds, the UK Student Mental Health Charity, and they created something which actually stemmed from the pandemic, which is called Student Space. But essentially, it's this platform where other students actually have shared their stories, which I find to be incredibly powerful. There's resources on there. There's obviously tips for looking after yourself, looking after a peer. We've got training called Look After Your Mate as well, which is basically how to support someone, how to spot the signs in someone, and, you know, what to do about that. And then, you know, looking after your own mental health whilst you're supporting someone as well, because obviously that's important too. Places like Mind and Papyrus, obviously Samaritans and Tons and tons of wonderful resources.
We should talk about the five core skills.
Mm-hmm.
So
yeah.
I think that's really important. So the New Economics Foundation, so the government, all those important people, they have, through lots of clinical research, come up with five core skills that all of us should be doing to give ourselves the best possible chance of being happy, but also being resilient and reducing the chance of becoming mentally unwell. So guess what the first one is? It's called being active. And we all do it.
Yeah.
We all do it. But from personal experience, if I don't do my workout 3-4 times a week, I'm a miserable sod.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I can relate.
Clinical research tells us that if we engage, and you know, you've got to find an activity that's going to suit your age and your level of mobility, of course. But you know, 3 sessions a week to points of breathlessness, absolutely on a chemical level, will change what's going on in your brain, and that's really, really important. So that's number one. And number two is called take notice, which people always get a bit freaked out by this word, but I'm going to say it: mindfulness. You know, and it probably conjures up this idea of some guru, loads of incense and stuff like that. And that's not what it's about. It's about slowing down and being present in the moment.
Yeah.
You know, and within that comes gratitude. And the way I describe it to people is just take notice of things. Mm-hmm. You know, we're not designed to live at the speed we're at. And number three is connect with people around you. I'll let Sophie take that one.
I mean, yeah, it's just the most important thing, isn't it? Connection with others. That's what sort of transformed my experience with my mental health. Just, you know, reaching out and forging those connections, realizing that you're not alone, creating those bonds. And, you know, as humans, we thrive off social connections.
Absolutely.
We're not supposed to, obviously you have to be okay with your own company for certain periods, but ultimately we're social beings. We want to be around other people.
Number four is give. And all that means is it just means give of yourself to others. So do some volunteer work. Okay, so I do volunteer counseling for people that either can't afford a therapist or they can't wait 2-3-4 months to see somebody on the NHS, very sadly.
Exactly. I also volunteer at Great Ormond Street Children's Hospital every week. And there's, if you just search for these opportunities, there's so many. And, you know, they're recruiting students all the time.
And number five, really pertinent, because we're talking about students, is keep learning.
Yeah.
Is keep learning. Okay.
I've done a lot of learning today.
Yeah. But what it is, it's
powerful.
It's not just about learning what you're choosing to do, so you're given subject. You know, there's loads of great things, particularly on the internet now. I used a thing called edX, which is some of the great unis around the world put their free courses online. And you could go, oh, do you know what? This week I want to learn about archaeology in the evening. So I'm going to do it. Yeah. Why not? Because you're challenging parts of your brain that you don't use all the time. And guess what? That increases our chemical hormone levels in our brain. Helps us to be better versions of ourselves.
Honestly, I cannot thank you both enough for coming and being so honest, open, and vulnerable.
Well, we need to do number two.
With us.
It's kind of true.
There are loads of tips and tricks out there. Make little changes, like, you know, use the word could instead of the word should.
Yeah.
You know, those little, dare I say, CBT changes make a massive difference.
Don't compare yourself. Don't, you know, feel judged about things. If you're struggling, reach out for help. If you're not sure of something, ask that question. Just, it's going to, you know, take your own time with it, because it's not necessarily going to happen straight away. And that's, honestly, that's okay. Just, you're going to be fine. And if it's not for you, don't feel that you have to stay. I'm a firm believer that it's not for everyone. It was the best thing I could have done, going to university. But if it's not for you, don't ever feel, you know, pressured. Just give it time.
Yeah. I guess a nice way to sort of end it would be to sort of just say to any of our listeners, if this has sort of opened up a space for you and you've got questions or you want to speak or reach out to anybody, we will have the links that Ben and Sophie have wonderfully 100%. Provided us with today for you to be able to access those, and just know that you're not alone.
Yeah. First step's always the hardest, but you've got to make it.